The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I've been away for a month teaching at the Forest Refuge in Massachusetts. And before that month, we had been exploring together the Eightfold Path. And so continue that today, but just a brief kind of overview, a brief overview of the Eightfold Path. Well, the Eightfold Path is, I think of it as a set of tools or practices that the Buddha offered to support us in living our lives. His vision or his understanding was that it's possible to live our lives in a way where we find freedom from suffering. Now, this doesn't mean freedom from unpleasant experience, but rather from the ways our minds react to situations in the world, the way our minds react to what's happening, kind of the liking certain things and wanting them to stay a certain way, not liking other things, wanting them to go away. There's a lot going on in our minds that affects how we interact, how we engage in the world, how we live our lives. And it's this mental struggle that the Buddha found is possible to be free of. A struggle against things as they are. A struggle against what is already here. So he found in his own life, his own practice, this possibility for a mind that is at ease, at peace with whatever's happening. But there's that possibility for ease of heart, peace of mind with whatever is happening in our lives, whatever's happening in the world. And yet it's helpful to understand what that means, because in English that word ease or peace, you know, it sounds like when we have ease or peace, it means we're not doing anything. It's like, well, when I'm peaceful, it means I don't have to take care of anything. When I'm peaceful, it means I don't have to do anything or act in any way. And yet my understanding of a peaceful heart in this way that the Buddha is talking about is that it would be very active, engaged in living in the world in a way that acts from compassion, from love, from kindness, from generosity, from wisdom. And so this peace of the Buddha's freedom from suffering isn't a peace that means you just sit there and kind of watch the world go by. It's a very engaged kind of peace, a peace that wants to act in the world to alleviate suffering, not out of aversion or greed or fear or confusion, but out of compassion. And so this is the possibility that he saw in his own experience. And the Eightfold Path is what he taught as a way that we can each find our own way towards this peace, that we can find our way towards this place of a heart that is not constricted around what's happening in the world. But I think of it as a heart that's more resonant, a heart that doesn't break and crack with what's happening in the world, but vibrates in empathy or in sympathy with what's going on in the world and is able to respond rather than react. And so this is the possibility, and the Eightfold Path is the way, the set of tools, the set of practices that will help us to find this possibility in our own lives. And so it's got 8 parts to it. You might think that with the Eightfold Path, it's 8 parts to this. And there's 3 sections to the path. The first 2 are in a section that's about wisdom. So the first two are wise understanding and wise intention. And this is really orienting us towards a direction to live our lives. Wise understanding is about, basically about orienting to what is this suffering anyway? It's that reframing of suffering from being something that's kind of happening to me, the world impinging on me and making me miserable, versus something, a possibility of recognizing that there's something going on in my own mind, some kind of reaction, resistance, holding on to, pushing away, that's creating that discomfort, that's creating that stress, that suffering. And so this is the wisdom of the Eightfold Path, is kind of a turning towards looking into our own hearts and minds for where any suffering, you know, what part of what we're suffering is being contributed by our own mental reactivity. And actually, in the Buddha, I think one of the things the Buddha discovered and teaches is that the reactivity of what's happening in our own minds is really the source of our suffering. It is why we suffer. It's not why we experience unpleasant experience. I mean, there is objectively unpleasant experience that happens in the world and people in very, very painful circumstances. And yet the possibility of recognizing that the heart can have some possibility of not being constricted, but being open, no matter what the circumstances are. That may be hard to fathom, and you don't really have to believe it at this point. But this is the pointing. This is the pointing that he suggests. And we can start. We start by looking in our own experience for ways that we're struggling, ways that we're suffering. And we often start with some obvious ones, you know, some obvious ways that we're engaged in the world and we fight and we struggle. And we begin to see, at least in some measure, we begin to see, oh yeah, well, there's some of it that's out there, but there is some of it that's in here. And we begin to look at our own anger, our own frustration, our own irritation, our own impatience, and begin to see that that part is contributing to the suffering that I'm experiencing. And maybe we learn something about that, and it begins to shift a little bit. And we see that, wow, when that impatience isn't there, when that anger isn't there, it's a whole different experience of navigating the world around that situation. There's more flexibility for response. It's not that I stop engaging and acting and doing in the world as the anger falls away. But there's a whole different motivation that begins to come into play, and a whole different relationship to the world. And so we may see some of what the Buddha is pointing to in our own experience. Maybe not the entirety of it, but it begins to lead us. It's like that. There's one saying that says that the Dharma is onward leading. Opanayiko is the Pali, leading onwards. And I think this is what part of why it's leading onward, because we start with just even a little bit of this wisdom, of this understanding. The right understanding of this. There's something in our own minds that's contributing to our suffering, and we may be curious about that. Maybe we don't completely believe what the Buddha says about all of our suffering being generated by our reactivity. But we may see, yeah, at least some of it is. And then as we see that and begin to recognize that as some of that releases and falls away, there's a whole different kind of engagement, a lot less suffering that happens, we may be willing to look a little deeper. And we see that's been beneficial. It's been beneficial to engage with the wise intention, the second aspect of the Eightfold Path, the intention to look at my experience in this way, and this has been helpful. And so it's onward leading in that way. As we, I remember when I first started this practice, I did not really understand how this could possibly, this practice of looking at my anger. Anger was really my first meditation object. And I didn't quite understand how being mindful of it, being curious about it, looking at it, investigating it would help. I thought it would just make me more angry. But I was willing to try it. I was willing to explore it. And within a very short time, within a couple weeks, I saw directly how it works. Just that observing of the anger helped kind of break into the cycle of anger, the spiral of anger earlier in the process, and just gave me some relief, gave me some, just even a little bit of space around the anger. That was huge for me. I was like, yeah, that's been helpful. I'll keep going. So this, the wisdom, the understanding, the wise understanding, wise intention is the beginning. It's how we even step onto this path. Some sense of the possibility of even some measure of release from some of our struggle and suffering can help us to step onto the path. And then it loops back for us because we gain some direct recognition of how powerful it is, and so we keep going. So it's like the next level deep begins to unfold. The next layer of reactivity begins to fall away. And so the wise understanding, wise intention kind of steps us onto this path. And then the Buddha pointed to, you know, kind of engagement with the world. This is another thing that I find very beautiful about the Eightfold Path. You know, often in these communities, you know, we emphasize a lot about the meditation, the practice, the sitting on the cushion. And yet the Eightfold Path really includes not only the activity of the practice internally, our own internal meditation and looking at our own minds, but also there's a whole section of the Eightfold Path, this next section, the ethics section, which looks at relationship. Looks at how we engage with our fellow human beings, or the other beings on the planet. It encourages us to engage with ethical conduct, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. And so the Eightfold Path includes not only looking at our own minds, but looking at our relationships, finding a way to live in harmony, live with skill, with kindness and care. And so this is the next piece of the Eightfold Path, is to look at our actions in the world, and can they, to look at the whole underpinning of the path is this question or this exploration around why do beings suffer, how do they suffer, and as we want to step into that investigation, to look at for ourselves, how and why do I suffer? We also see that in relationship with each other, unethical behavior, harming other beings, taking what's not offered, creating harm with sexuality and speaking falsely, these things create suffering in the world. And so as we kind of want to land in this exploration of what does it mean to live in a way that moves me in the direction of freedom from suffering, we are inclined towards living not only internally but externally in a way to not contribute to suffering in the world. And so we engage, we step into this engagement with ethical conduct, treating each other with care and kindness. So this is the second aspect of the Eightfold Path that includes wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. And the third section of the path comes back to the inner cultivation, the cultivation of our own investigation into our own hearts and minds, the meditative practices. The third section of the Eightfold Path is called the samadhi section, the concentration section, and it's really how to cultivate a mind that can look into itself, explore what's happening, as the Buddha did in his own practice, to explore what was going on in there, and seeing how the movements of reactivity created conditions that were optional. I mean, that was a big eye opener. We see actually that some of that reactivity, it feels so much like it just has to happen, that this thing happens and I get angry, or that thing happens and I get frustrated. But as we start to look, we begin to see it's actually optional. It's very deeply conditioned, but it doesn't have to unfold. It doesn't have to head that way. As we start to train our minds in this way, we begin to see there's a little space. There can be a little space between the intention of something arising in our mind and the movement or action in the world. And so there is this possibility of changing the direction of our minds. And so the third aspect of the Eightfold Path includes wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. And these three really work together to help us to explore our inner landscape, to see what's going on in our own minds. It's quite amazing that we can actually look at our own minds. And so the one I'd like to talk about in a little more detail tonight is wise effort. This is kind of the beginning of our inner exploration. And so wise effort follows on from the ethical section of the path. So it's wise understanding, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. And so that part of the path, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, is really about cleaning up our relationship in the world, and orienting to kindness externally. And I think of wise effort as being the beginning of kind of looking at internally our own relationship, the relationships of what's happening in our own hearts and minds. And so in the wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, we look at engaging externally with care, with kindness, with compassion. With wise effort, we look at cultivating internally skillful states of mind and letting go of unskillful states of mind. And so this is the teaching on wise effort really incorporates or includes an understanding. It kind of links back or hooks back to wise understanding, because wise effort incorporates an understanding of wisdom in terms of how we engage with effort. Right effort, wise effort. The Eightfold Path uses this term right. Sama is the Pali. Sama, vayama is the Pali for right effort. But the word right here, to me, what that means is, if you want to go somewhere, if I'm giving you directions to get somewhere, I can tell you, well, if you follow this path, you will get to the place. That's the path. That's the right path to go on if you have this aim or this goal of a place to go. And so it's the right direction. The direction, another direction, is not going to take you to that place, and so it's the wrong direction. But it's not so much of a, that's the way in which it's right. It's a direction that leads us towards our aim of releasing suffering. That it, in that sense, it is right effort. And that that effort needs to be aimed by our purpose, which is the release of suffering. And so that brings in the understanding of what is it that creates the suffering in our internal landscape. In the external landscape, a lot of what creates the suffering is these unskillful actions. In the internal landscape, it is states of mind that tend to create the suffering. And the clearest or most concise definition that I know of unskillful and skillful states of mind, so this is kind of the whole way that wise effort is framed, is looking at letting go of, abandoning the unskillful and cultivating the skillful in terms of the direction of finding freedom, release from suffering. And the unskillful states of mind are those that are connected to or rooted in greed, aversion, and delusion. And the skillful states of mind are those that are rooted in non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. Or to put it in a more positive language, love, compassion, and wisdom. Or generosity. Non-greed, we could say, would be generosity. Non-aversion is love, compassion. And non-delusion is wisdom. And so these are what the Buddha points to in terms of when we are motivated by greed to hold on to things, there's a constriction there. There's a tightening there. When we're motivated by aversion, there's again a tightening there. It's when we look into our experience and feel the experience of greed, and we feel the experience of aversion, we can see for ourselves that this experience is already suffering. It's already, the word suffering is a pretty big word, but what we can feel is that when we are experiencing greed, the wanting to hold on to something, the aversion, pushing it away, when we notice that experience itself, we see that we already have a kind of a non-ease in that very experience of greed or aversion. The heart is not at ease. The heart is not peaceful when it is experiencing greed and aversion. Now, the whole way this has worked for us is that we have not really seen the greed and aversion themselves, because those states of mind have a delusive hook in them. They have a kind of a delusive, view. The delusive view of greed is something along the lines of, if you get that thing, then you'll be happy. And the delusive, and the happiness is going to be lasting. That's the other piece, that it's seduced us into believing that that is what's going to do it for us, that we will have it figured out if we get that thing. And likewise with aversion, there's this kind of delusive sense that, yeah, this is what I have to do. I have to control that thing, I have to get rid of that thing, and then I will be okay. And I'm not going to be okay unless I can control that thing. That's the other piece of the delusion in there. It's like the delusion of greed tells us you are not going to be okay unless you get that thing. You are going to be miserable forever unless you get that thing. And so that's where our minds are going. It's like that they're reaching out to what's out there, whether it's a material thing, or it's wanting somebody to see us in a certain way. The mind is kind of living with greed, particularly in a fantasy that when I get that thing, I'll be good. Things will be good. And so in that, living in that fantasy, in that sense of, yeah, get that thing, you'll be okay, we are basically missing And likewise with aversion, it's a similar thing. You know, get rid of that thing, control that thing, you'll be okay. So we are living in that hope for the future, or that sense of, yeah, that's where I'm going to be happy. And basically we're missing that we're suffering right now. That the greed and the aversion that are happening right now are creating that stress in our experience. And so as we begin to be curious and explore, we begin to see these functions of mind, these greed, aversion, and delusion, as something that is creating suffering. And this is a huge shift. This is where we begin to understand that wise view for ourselves, that wise understanding that the Buddha is pointing to. We begin to see, it doesn't actually, in the moment, it doesn't feel good. It something feels off. And as we begin to explore it, also as we begin to explore, we see that, you know, that we may begin to see that sometimes that greed or aversion will weaken and fall away, and we may begin to recognize that there's another possibility, that there can be an ease or a happiness that comes with the letting go of that desire or aversion. A whole different kind of happiness than the getting of something. And again, you don't have to believe this so much, but just as we begin, you know, just even the curiosity, and certainly I did not believe this when I first started, but I was willing enough to engage with the start of looking at it, the start of looking at anger and being curious about anger itself. It was like, it slapped me upside the head. It's like, wow, this sure hurts. How could I have not noticed how painful anger was before? And this was the beginning of the exploration. And it was not that long before I really began to understand how mindfulness begins to support a releasing of these energies. And so we begin to see that greed, aversion, and delusion are not so helpful. We begin to be interested in the possibility of their release, of their abandonment, of the letting go of them, and get more interested in the other side, the wholesome qualities. And so this is what right effort is about. And the right effort is framed with four aspects. Two of them have to do with letting go of and avoiding and abandoning, or sometimes the words used there, avoiding unwholesome states that have not yet arisen. So avoiding states of greed, aversion, and delusion that have not yet arisen, and abandoning states of greed, hatred, and delusion that have arisen. Those are the first two. And the second two are cultivating wholesome states of mind. So cultivating love, compassion, wisdom, patience, joy, generosity. Cultivating wholesome states of mind that have not yet arisen, and exploring the maintaining or supporting or cultivation of wholesome states that have arisen. So these are the four right efforts or wise efforts. And I just want to talk about each one a little bit, to give you a little bit of a flavor of each one, how it works, how they come into our practice, because these are really kind of foundational explorations for us. We start to get curious about our minds. We start to get curious about what's arising right now. Is it an unwholesome state of mind? How do I work with that? Is it a wholesome state of mind? How do I work with that? How do I explore that? And so the first one, avoiding unwholesome states that have not yet arisen. So this is basically, you know, we begin to recognize or get familiar with states of mind like anger, frustration, irritation, greed, pride, avarice, boredom, confusion, delusion, all of these kind of reactive states that we begin to recognize as being suffering. You know, as we get curious about our experience, we see we probably begin to recognize some very familiar patterns. For me, anger was a big one, impatience was a big one. And so these were some ones that I looked at early on. And so, like with impatience, for instance, you know, we begin to see certain situations, certain conditions in which some of these familiar habits tend to be strong. And so, for instance, for myself, you know, discovering that impatience was strong in my mind when I was running late. This is kind of obvious in some ways, you know. I'm running late, I hit a red light, and I am like, you know, really frustrated, impatient with that red light. It's like, well, I can't change the light. I can't make the light do what I want it to do. And here's this impatience that is making this being feel stress. As we begin to recognize that impatience actually is optional, we get curious about, well, what might be conditions that could support the non-arising of impatience? One of the things that could support that is leaving early. You know, so just beginning, we just start to look at our lives and find circumstances, conditions that when we find ourselves in our habitual habits and patterns, are there conditions that we might be able to change through our own actions in a simple way? You know, so other times I discovered that, you know, one of the big things I discovered was that I would get kind of crazy aversive when I got really hungry. And you know, I was not a very good traveling companion that way. You know, I would start yelling at the person who was driving when I got really hungry about, no, there's a restaurant, go there. Oh, you missed the turn. Why did you miss the turn? And so you know, so this was conditions. I discovered at some point that basically what was happening is that my body got extremely uncomfortable with the hunger. And it happened very quickly, you know. It's like there was just a drop-off point. I think I had some kind of, like, blood sugar thing going or something. And so, you know, learning to bring some snacks with me. Also learning to warn my companions, you know, if I start behaving really strangely, just drive to a restaurant, sit me down, and order me some food, because I'm not going to be able to even pick the food. I'm going to be in such a state. So, you know, beginning to learn what the conditions are to help kind of navigate this situation. So, you know, just learning how to create conditions to, you know, what are the conditions that really catch us? And there's certain things that we can do to help mitigate those. Now, this can have some subtlety to it because, you know, so avoiding unwholesome states that have not yet arisen, you know, it might be that we see, whenever I see this particular person, that I get angry. You know, it's like, so maybe that means that I should just never see that person again. Well, that's not quite what the teaching is about. You know, the exploration becomes a little more nuanced here, you know, to begin to be curious about what are the conditions for the arising of that anger. It's not as simple as that person causes the anger. It's not quite that simple. You know, it's that we might think it's that simple, but there's something else going on there. You know, so you see that person and what happens? You think about something that they did to you in the past. Or maybe it's not even something about that person at all. Maybe it's just that they remind you of somebody that did something to you. And so we start to get curious about what is actually the trigger. And begin to explore, you know, recognizing, oh, so I am seeing that person, I tend to get angry. So maybe I can be curious about what happens there. So this leads into the second kind of wise effort, the effort to abandon unwholesome states that have arisen. So this is that place where something, so you see that person and there is anger. You know, it's there. It's already there. You don't get the opportunity to say, oh, don't go there. It's there. It's already arisen. And so the word abandon, you know, the simple way to look at this one is that when something, when reactive mind states based in greed, aversion, and delusion arise, that we make the effort to let go of that. But this letting go can take many forms. It may be that we can have some capacity to recognize, okay, yep, I tend to get angry with this person, and you know, I actually see it's not about this person. So it may be that we can do some inner coaching. You know, well, it's not really about this person. I see that it's just that they remind me of somebody. And so we may be able to do some inner coaching that will help us to distance ourselves from our reaction a little bit. Maybe. We may be able to redirect our attention sometimes. We may find that, for instance, on the freeway or something, you're driving and somebody cuts you off. You know, in that kind of a situation, if you stay focused on the fact that that person cut you off, that may be kind of keeping the reactivity going. And if you instead recognize, wow, as I keep thinking about that person that cut me off, it's contributing to staying angry, you might be able to consciously recognize, okay, let me take my attention out of that thought and put it in another thought. Let me think about something else, essentially. Let me redirect the attention. So that's a way of kind of actively letting go of the mind being caught in something. So that kind of redirecting the attention. This kind of action of actively letting go can be useful. And yet it's really important in that kind of practice. And I've used it a lot in my own practice, especially around anger. At one point, I discovered that trying to be mindful of anger at certain times, you know, when I actually was exploring being present with my reactive emotions, sometimes I could be present with them. But sometimes I saw certain ones were so strong that trying to be mindful of it actually made it worse. It just took me down the rabbit hole of that emotion. It just caught me up in it. And so I realized, okay, that's not the time to try to be mindful of that. So let me redirect the attention. I will, when I see that come up, I will just like put my attention in my feet. I'll take a walk and I'll just put my attention in my feet. I'll just put my attention in something neutral. That kind of shift away from something. So recognizing, yep, there's that anger and not the time to be mindful of it, but put my attention in something neutral. That has to be done with just such a kindness in our hearts. It's like, I would just like see that anger and I'd say, yeah, oh, anger, I see you. I'd bow to it. I see you. And oh, I just you're so strong right now. So you can take a walk with me, but I'm going to put my attention in my feet. So that it was really a very gentle redirection. It was not an aversive pushing away. And this is really important in this active letting go or the active movement of abandoning. If there's any aversion in the abandoning, it is paradoxically, maybe not so paradoxically, because the movement of aversion is going to kind of just reinforce that thing that we are averse to. And so if I were pushing that anger away with aversion, it's like it just multiplies that pattern. And so the shifting away, the active redirecting when we look at abandoning an unwholesome state actively in that way has to be done with a lot of compassion in the heart. Like, yep, I see you, and yeah, take a walk with me, but I'm going to put my attention someplace else. You know, yeah, you can come along for the ride, but I'm going to pay attention to something else. That was actually extremely powerful, a very, very powerful tool in my own practice. It was a very powerful way to work with that particular pattern. It had a very strong and deep releasing, healing quality that supported the ultimate letting go of that pattern. So that's one way that we can work with this abandoning. But I'd say by far the larger and more familiar way, the way that becomes a lot of our practice, is maybe what we could call the letting be approach rather than the letting go approach. So this is where we turn with mindfulness to whatever that experience is. Anger's arising, frustration's arising, impatience is arising, confusion is arising. We explore, what is this experience? What is this human experience of anger, of frustration? What is that like? That is, again, when I first learned this, I just did not fathom how that could possibly work. When I heard this, be aware of your anger, be aware of whatever reactivity, I thought, won't that just make me more angry? But there's something about the curiosity and the willingness to observe it as a human experience. It's like, this is what it's like for a human being to be feeling this reactivity. It's a completely different thing than being caught in that reactivity. It's as if when we're caught in the reactivity, when we are kind of tumbling along with that reactivity, we are, our gears are engaged. You know, we are going full throttle with our foot on the accelerator, gears are engaged, and that pattern is just reinforcing itself, that reactive pattern. What mindfulness does is disengage the gears, like puts that pattern into neutral effectively. And so we could say that what we are doing with mindfulness, with our reactive patterns, is abandoning the engagement with them. We're abandoning the buying into them and opening to seeing the pattern as a human experience. It's hard initially to trust that will have power to it. It was a little bit for me, but pretty quickly actually it began to point out that, oh, this actually works. This actually is helpful to abandon the engagement. There's something that happens there. So this is a lot of our practice, is exploring how do we meet our reactive patterns with mindfulness. And recognizing when it is time to step aside, because as I said, with my own exploration around some of my reactive patterns, I saw sometimes it was like the reactive pattern was this huge wave, and mindfulness was barely a little trickle, and the mindfulness just was swamped by the energy of the pattern. And so when that's going on, that is not the time to try to be with that pattern. So again, learning, at, you know, with some wisdom, we learn when is it time to step aside and when is it time to explore that disengagement, abandoning the engagement. When we can abandon the engagement, that is a very powerful way of engaging with this second aspect of wise effort. The third kind of wise effort, the third and fourth, are really looking at the flip side, looking at cultivating the wholesome, maintaining the wholesome, and, you know, bringing it into being. And so this is where we begin to look at the first being arousing wholesome states that have not yet arisen. So this is recognizing that it's useful to kind of incline the mind in the direction of love, of compassion, of wisdom, of patience. There's a couple different ways to explore this piece. One is that, so to cultivate wholesome states of mind, we have to, there's two kind of ways. One is that we avoid things that get in the way of those wholesome states. So we can cultivate wholesome qualities. So the whole ethical aspect of the Eightfold Path is doing this to some extent. And if we look at the ethical conduct, refraining from taking life, refraining from taking what's not given, each of these actions is paired with a beautiful, wholesome quality that is simultaneously cultivated as we engage with that refraining. And so we engage in refraining from taking life. And it, if we are not just doing this because somebody told me to do this, but we are actively interested in encouraging the kind of like inclining towards the cultivation of the wholesome while we are abandoning the actions that would oppose those wholesome qualities. So the refraining from taking life cultivates the possibility for compassion. So just that action creates the conditions for compassion. Refraining from taking what's not given cultivates the possibility for contentment. And so this is a piece of the cultivating the wholesome, that we abstain from things, from actions that would oppose the wholesome states. And we may begin at times even to see that just simple things, like I found in my own practice, that a practice over a period of several months of working with not killing the ants in my kitchen, but finding a different way to shepherd them outside. It had actually ended up creating a relationship between me and the ants. And there was, to my shock, at one point, a real growth of feeling of connection and compassion and care for these beings. Just through, and I wasn't even trying to have that happen, but what I was trying to do was engage in not killing. And so this is possible. This is a way for that cultivation of these wholesome states. And then we can also cultivate these wholesome states through positive cultivation. So, for instance, the practice of loving kindness, where we actively cultivate thoughts of kindness, bring thoughts of kindness into our mind. May you be happy. May all beings be happy and healthy and safe. So just consciously inclining the mind in that direction, using thought towards wholesome qualities, can create the conditions for those wholesome qualities. This is a whole talk itself, and so I won't go into this so much, but this is one way that this right effort comes into play. In our mindfulness practice, one of the ways this right effort comes into play is that we are cultivating the wholesome quality of mindfulness. We are engaging in the practice of mindfulness, which one of my teachers, Saito Upandita, said, this is the most wholesome mind state. Wise mindfulness is the most wholesome mind state. And so we are actively cultivating that capacity in our minds. So that is the cultivation of wholesome states. The practice of mindfulness cultivates mindfulness, which is kind of the ground out of which the other wholesome qualities can also grow. And the fourth quality, the fourth kind of right effort, the effort to sustain wholesome states that have already arisen, When I first was thinking about this, I thought, well, why would that take effort? I mean, wouldn't that be easy? But in my own experience, I discovered actually there were times when it wasn't so easy. You know, that the mind actually, at least my mind, I had so much orientation towards the negative. I mean, I would go into a room and it's like, what's wrong here? That was so much my orientation that it was very difficult when a beautiful, wholesome quality like love or joy arose. It's like it was so unfamiliar. It was hard to kind of let it flourish. And what I discovered is actually one of the best ways to make wholesome qualities flourish is to be mindful of them. So this is, again, the practice of mindfulness as we bring that capacity of mindfulness to when love arises, when patience arises, when we see that these are happening. You know, through the investigation, through being with our experience, we see these wholesome qualities arise sometimes. We might see that we feel friendly towards a person who's trying to merge on the freeway and back off. And it's like, well, can we notice that? Can we notice that kindness? Notice that generosity of that action and appreciate it. It feels good. That reinforces those qualities. And mindfulness is this amazing quality that both simultaneously weakens the reactive states. Because as we see the reactive states, our system gets the education that these reactive states are not the way to well-being. And so when we are mindful of, in that disengaging the gears fashion, abandoning the engagement, when we're mindful of them, we see, oh, this is not the way to well-being. And likewise, when we are mindful of love and compassion and joy and patience and generosity, there's a deep recognition, this is the way to well-being. And so it tends to encourage those qualities of mind. And so this is a way, actually, in which the mindfulness practice itself, actually, sometimes, this is the next step on the Eightfold Path is wise mindfulness, but I just want to bring this in now because it's sometimes a confusion or a question. It's like, this right effort sounds like all this doing of, I'm supposed to abandon the unwholesome and I'm supposed to cultivate the wholesome, so shouldn't I spend my time letting go and stopping the reactive states and practicing metta? Thinking that's what the cultivation of these means. But if we look at what mindfulness does, and this may be why Sayadaw Upandita says mindfulness is the most wholesome mind state. Just the practice of mindfulness with anything that's arising. If we are practicing mindfulness of anger, we are cultivating that disengagement. So we are cultivating that, abandoning the engagement when we bring mindfulness to it. As we do that, we are cultivating the conditions for it to appear less in our minds in the future. Because our mind begins to understand this is not helpful, it begins to let it go. And so the mindfulness practice around our reactive pattern already takes care of those first two wise efforts. It's simultaneously helping us to abandon something that's here and creating the conditions for its not coming in the future. It's creating conditions for its future non-arising. Simultaneously with that, we are cultivating the wholesome state of mindfulness. So that's happening already. We may also see other things there as we open to being present with it. We may see not only that there's some measure of capacity to meet a difficult state, we may find in a funny way that there's a kind of a quality of curiosity and joy and interest, a sense of ease that can be around that difficult experience. So some wholesome, beautiful qualities of mind that are coming along for the ride as we are being mindful, It can be a funny thing. When we see, wow, there's this impatience happening, and yet there's so much joy, the seeing of it. There's delight in the mind and some ease about it. So these are wholesome qualities that are being cultivated as we practice mindfulness with something difficult, with a reactive pattern. And that, again, the being aware of those. So we're encouraging the arising of mindfulness through this. So encouraging the arising of these wholesome states and encouraging their continuing by being mindful of them. And so mindfulness itself, the practice of mindfulness, already contains these four right efforts. You don't have to do anything else except begin to recognize whether that mindfulness is, you know, is like the time when I saw that mindfulness, it's not able to meet that pattern. And so then I needed to bring in some of the active tools of wise effort, the redirecting, the abandoning, the turning away from, not with aversion, but with compassion. But when we can practice the mindfulness, it already is taken care of. It's already cultivating these four right efforts for us. And it's time to stop. So a couple minutes over, I apologize for that. Thank you for your attention.